Welcome to Frankly Speaking on the TurfNet Radio Network. Here is your host, Dr. Frank Rossi.
Thank you, and welcome to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi, Associate Professor of Horticulture in Cornell University, TURF member of the TURFnet.com blogger group and the TURFnet radio network. This is another in the many episodes of Frankly Speaking where we try to delve into topics that oftentimes get missed, and particularly at this time of year in the northeastern United States or any part of the northern United States where really the 8 to 10 weeks of stress is on for the putting surfaces and golf courses that we work to manage. So in light of that, I had the pleasure of reading an article in the official publication of the Canadian Golf Course Superintendents, Green Master. It was the May-June issue, and in it, my guest today, Professor David Huff, who's the professor of turfgrass genetics at Penn State University, wrote an article entitled The Evolutionary Arms Race. And it's an article pretty much between a relationship that golf course superintendents have been developing for many, many years between themselves and annual bluegrass. And so to help us explore this wonderful article and to give us more insight into this, I welcome Professor Huff. And David, welcome to the show, and thanks for taking the time to talk with us about this really interesting article that you wrote that I have been commending to as many people as possible. And essentially, you know, there's many ways to go here, David, but let's start out with a simple conversation that, you know, runs through my head in all the years I've known and followed your work. You know, at a university where it's probably as known as any for its creeping bentgrasses, obviously Pencross back in the 50s, and then more recently, you know, the Penn Lynx, Penn Eagle, and then obviously into the A and G series bentgrasses that were released in the 90s. So how does a guy breeding grass at Penn State University, home of many of the bentgrasses, decide to start working with the arch enemy, one might think, of the bentgrasses, annual bluegrass?
Well, hi, Frank. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Being at the home of creeping bentgrass and breeding and working on Poa annua, the most noxious weed in the golf industry, it was kind of interesting. So when I first got here, a brand new assistant professor, I was looking for some projects, and I hadn't worked much with the golf industry prior to coming here, and I was I had some low mo Kentucky bluegrasses that I thought might be good for fairways. You know, the gray leaf spot disease was coming on, and people were looking for alternatives to perennial ryegrass. But I didn't get a lot of interest, honestly, from the industry on that, the local golf course superintendents. But I also had some fine fescues that, you know, you put them in the roughs and you don't mow them and they look, you know, native. And they would say, yeah, well, what else are you working on? And I had this idea for Poa annua. And anytime I would mention that, the superintendents would pull me off to the side and they'd say, Poa annua, I'll tell you all about Poa annua. And I quickly realized that, you know, no matter where you're at in the industry, whether you got bent greens or Poa greens, at some time in your career, you're having to deal with Poa annua, and everybody has some stories on that. And so I started to kind of float the idea among my professor colleagues here, and to their credit, you know, they never said, no, that's the weed, you know, that's the evil enemy, we can't work on that. On the contrary, they said, hey, why don't you explore it a little bit, you know, work on it a little bit, see if there's anything pans out, and just take it from there. And so that's kind of what I did, is I arrived here in 1994 and made my first collections down in western PA, and quickly realized that, you know, this Poa annua knows how to play the game better than just about any other grass I've ever seen.
That's right. And I tell you, that, you know, and that statement right there is a good place for me to interrupt, because that ability to adapt to the conditions is exactly what the basis of this article that you wrote is. Now, the beauty of it for me, David, and this is where I want you to go now, is that, you know, it's one thing for two scientists to be talking theoretically and hypothetically, but one of the great things you've done is you've done, especially with La Mancha there, some really good basic science about the sort of genetics of this. And let me see if I can bug you to tell one more story. So I know you then, you know, thought to develop, or the Minnesota guys developed the, you know, the TruPut, or the DW184, as it was known. So they go to produce it for seed, right? They go to produce it for seed, and lo and behold, in normal seed rows, the seed they collect and then send to us looked a whole, for somebody that actually planted it, it looked a hell of a lot like the true annual type. So one of the great things that I want you to talk about is this science that you've really brought to this, particularly around that issue, because there is a POA available, but your work with epigenetics is really the underpinnings of this conversation. Can you take a minute and wander us through, you know, DW184, release of the seed, and then ultimately what you found with Mr. Lamantia?
Yes, well, and a lot of people had that same experience as you did, Frank. When they, you know, they're very excited to be able to get a commercial source of a greens-type POA annua, and they would plant it out there, and these things would just, like, they would go to flower, and they would set so many seeds, and oh my gosh, it was just, I saw that planted in so many different parts of the world, and oh God, it was just awful.
Right.
Well, as this is just as I was starting to develop my own commercial cultivars of greens types, and I'd spoke with the seed producer who was producing that DW184, and he said, Huff, you gotta let us produce your material, because when Don White sent us DW184, it was only producing about 200 pounds of seed per acre, and we got that thing producing over 1,000 pounds per acre. Well, what he was producing at 1,000 pounds per acre wasn't what Don White had given him. It had reverted back from that greens type form to the wild weedy annual form. And we were kind of seeing it from a different standpoint. You know, in the plant breeding process, you start out with just a half a handful of seed from one little plant, and you plant that out into rows and increase that seed. Now you're up to a small paper bag. And then you take that and you increase it again, and now you're getting, you know, maybe 10, 15 pounds or so. And every time we'd plant this out, you would start seeing these wild weedy annual types come up. And I was all over my technician, you know, we got to keep these fields clean. We got to come up with some way to keep these wild weedy annuals out. But what was happening, in fact, it wasn't my technician's fault. These plants were reverting back to the annual types. And so I put my graduate student on, and we started doing a lot of crosses to work out the genetics. And that's when we discovered that the segregation ratios don't fit any known genetic mechanism of transmission.
Okay, so English now, because I'm not a breeder and a smart guy like you. Segregation ratios, in simple terms, what I heard from and paid attention to the work that you were doing was when you stopped mowing it intensively, it reverted back in one generation, correct?
Well, that's right. So some strains
will revert back. Is that the segregation ratio, that after just one generation it went back?
No, that's really that epigenetic system. So segregation ratio, that's Gregor Mendel and his P experiments, where you make a cross and then they'll segregate 3 to 1, or standard segregation ratios. But with what we were finding, and actually our first cross, so we crossed a perennial with an annual, and the F1 progeny, the first generation progeny, was annual. And then we took the seed of that annual and planted it out, and we got a 3 to 1 ratio. Three quarters of the population were annual, and one quarter was perennial. And that says that it's a single gene with two alleles, the simplest genetic model there is. But and that's really the power of genetics, so you can predict what you're going to get in the future. So when we took,
Go ahead, keep going. Now I'm following.
yeah,
Go.
so when we took those advanced generations, when we cross a perennial with a perennial, we should always get perennial. That's it. That's all you should ever get. And we weren't getting that. We were getting 50% annual, 50% perennial, sometimes 75% annual. It didn't fit any rules of genetics. And that's when we started really scratching our heads, saying, what's going on here? And we really had to find out, how polyannua came to be in the first place. And I set another graduate student on that, and we did discover that. We found that polyannua is a hybrid between two other poa species, Poa supina, which you might have heard of. They use it a lot on fairways over in Europe, and we've used a
Yeah,
little
I
bit here
planted
in
some on some
athletic
shaded
field.
peas. Yep, I've done some shaded pea work with Poa supina.
And the other
And what's
parent
the
is
other one?
Poa, Poa infirma, and that's also known as weak bluegrass, and that is a true annual. It only lives about 8 or 10 weeks, and it sets seed and dies, just like corn or wheat or any of those annual grains. So those are the two parents, and what we found out from that study is genetically those parents are like different plant genera. They are so genetically different that it's very remarkable. But yet when they hybridize, they can make polyannua species, and that's the origin of polyannua. And we think
So,
that because those parents are so different, it's given polyannua a very unique genetic basis, and that's
a wide
what's
genetic basis,
operating.
in other words, a wide genetic basis that potentially gives it two really important things for many weedy species. One is high reproductive capacity, two is ability to adapt and dominate in an environment where it can grow.
That's right. And so the Infirma parent of Poa annua is highly invasive, lots of seeds, and the perennial parent of Poa annua, the supina, is highly vegetative and lots of stolons and very very turf-like. But the interesting thing, Frank, is that Poa supina, what I've seen over in Europe, it'll take a fairway height to cut. But at that fringe of the green, it starts thinning out, and then you really can't find it under a green's height of cut.
So,
And
Dave,
so
I want to go
if
back to something you said. You actually can tell genetically, if we give you plants, you could say it's an annual versus it's a perennial, because I thought that was only something that you generally determined morphologically from leaf texture and determination or non-determination of flowering. Either it's an indeterminate flower or it's a determinate flowering. Are you saying that you can determine from genetics whether it is a true annual or a true perennial?
Well, we can now. We so the greens types are, they're a dwarf form, and when we thought it was the GA, gibberellic acid biosynthesis pathway, so we cloned out all the genes, and we didn't find any mutants there. We dug back through the literature and found out that the mutant for the greens type is really in the auxin biosynthesis pathway.
Okay.
And so what happens is there's still, you know, the basic scientists are still working out the details of auxin biosynthesis, but there's a molecule called the ARF gene or the ARF protein. It's ARF, like a dog barks, ARF. And it stands for auxin response factor. And that ARF protein is kind of chained up to the auxin biosynthesis pathway, but the mutation that we found breaks that chain, and that ARF molecule can travel over and interfere with the GA biosynthesis pathway. And that's what it does.
That keeps it in a dwarf condition.
And it chews up, so everything, all the machinery in the GA biosynthesis pathway is fine, but it chews up the GA, the bioactive GA, and so you get a dwarf plant. It's like putting on a plant growth regulator. You get this.
Interesting you say that, because, right, the three primary ones that are used are all GA inhibitors, and as we've been taught, getting involved in the GA pathways either early in the process for things like fluoprimidol and pacobutrazol, and then later on in the process, things like trinexipac and I believe the new PGR Renew is. But David, you know, this is pretty deep into the genetic stuff. I want to take a break now and go to a message from our sponsors. And when I come back, now I believe, you know, we've sort of laid enough of a genetic foundation that we sort of know, you have a sense genetically at the baseline level what we're talking about. And when we come back after this break, I actually want to get into the discussion about how management maintenance plans can significantly impact that. We'll be right back with Professor David Huff.
Dryject is a revolutionary service that relieves compaction, increases water filtration, improves gas exchange, and amends your root zone, all at the same time, leaving the turf surface smooth and playable. Visit dryject.com to locate your nearest Dryject service center.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. I'm Frank Rossi. This is the TurfNet Radio Network. You're listening to Frankly Speaking, and my guest today, Professor David Huff, professor of turfgrass genetics at Penn State University, and talking about his article, The Evolutionary Arms Race. But really what we spent our time with in the beginning of this conversation, David, has been primarily on the science that I think gives what you're writing the credibility that I think superintendents need to be mindful of. So with the backdrop that now you've got diagnostic tools for determining how these genes are reacting, what's happening at a metabolic level with auxins and leaf, and essentially leaf elongation, dwarfism, the underpinnings of the greens type or Oakmont POA that everybody talks about. Obviously now, as a breeder, you're charged with sort of developing grasses, right, for people to, you know, use in their system, whether it's for food or fiber or, in our case, golf courses. How do we take what you've learned, you know, in the way this species, I would only describe it as very plastic or elastic in nature, how would you then take what you've learned to bring us right to the Red Queen analogy that you've talked about in this article, where, you know, you've got to run really fast just to stay and stay in the same place? So we've got a species that we know can adapt dramatically, can look different morphologically, can respond differently to practices. How do we sort of take what you've learned at a basic level and think about and envision that Red Queen analogy that you used for the article?
Yeah, well, I think that's the basic take-home message here, is that POA annua, is so adaptable. It has extensive phenotypic plasticity, so it can adjust to different environmental conditions. It can rapidly evolve. Any control system really is never 100% effective. And so there's those survivors then are able to pass on their resistance genes to the next generation. And then since they're resistant, they can spread and dominate. And then thirdly, it has this epigenetic mechanism. And that's sort of a new area, new field in genetics, and it's quite wide ranging. But essentially, it's the organism adapting its gene expression to environmental conditions. And that's really kind of what we see with the effect of mowing on Poa annua. So in my vision of Poa annua, as you're mowing it, you're shutting down that GA pathway, and you get a more and more dwarf plant. Now, this happens over a long period of time, but that's really what we're seeing when you go to really old, established, high-end Poa annua greens, is you're seeing these dwarf types that have adapted over a long period of time to that close mowing.
So with that in mind, okay. So now we've got let's just, because we have a lot of old courses, and I've been visiting, golf courses probably like you for better part of 20 years looking at these sorts of things. And so we have this great old golf course. Let's imagine it's in the Greater Toronto Area, for example, where the devastating winter injury went through last year, right? So I'm trying to take the basic science you've got and look at these practical challenges these guys face, because when we go to northern climates, like, for example, into Canada or, even through Michigan and Chicago last year that had the winter damage 2 years ago, I really like Poa annua. It's really good, but it dies in the winter. So what is it about, let's just for a second take winter and say, okay, this must be something it can't adapt to because it's continuing to die, every year from it. So, and then the other question, first of all, it's the lack of adaptation to that sort of lethal stress, number one. Number two, it's now that it's dead, stuff starts to grow back. What should I do? Should I plug bent grass in? Should I try other Poa that, is survived somewhere else? So two questions. One is, talk a little bit about the lethal stress sometimes that we get either from winter or basal rot anthracnose, for example, and then ultimately how these things recolonize these greens.
Well, and that's Poa annua really will suffer at both ends of the temperature spectrum, severe cold and severe heat. And we've sort of worked on both ends of those. We actually found most of our highest level of tolerance to cold temperatures right here in Pennsylvania. So I think up in Canada, they typically have a very deep snowpack, and that sort of insulates the grass. And then when they do have a severe winter and there's severe temperatures or a lack of snow, that grass is very susceptible to those cold temperatures.
Well, and so it's not so there's two things there, and then now that I've asked that and I've heard what you said, typically what is happening, I think almost everybody would say that when we get that devastating winter damage, it's the breaking of dormancy in the spring. It's that rapid, I got to start growing to get an advantage, that a weed tells itself to get out of the gate really quick. It gets out of the gate really quick and then, breaks dormancy, and that oftentimes makes it more susceptible to the cold temperatures that come. I don't know that the direct low temperature kill is common. It seems more like they're breaking dormancy. And as you said, it appears to be something that the grass simply can't adapt to.
Well, and that's part of its strategy, I think, and it's probably adapting it, but not the way we want it to. It's as soon as that temperature, gets a little, 3 degrees C, just above freezing. That POA is breaking dormancy, and it's, like you say, it's trying to grow and cover ground, and that's sort of its strategy. It seems to work for it. We would like it to be more dormant and wait for that spring to come out, or the warmer temperatures in spring to come out, but it just never seems to want to do that. Now, with some breeding, we might be able to find some types. You have to realize that really everything we're looking out there in the industry concerning POA annua, it's just whatever happens to be out there. It's never right. been bred. It's just survived through sort of natural selection.
So with that in mind, now, you know, it's something that's, you know, it's a strategy it uses. It's adapting, maybe not the way we want it to, but so now we've lost turf. Let's say we've lost the annual bluegrass that we had that was there
right.
for
yeah.
a shame, maybe a shame for 80 years or something. And then the climate's changing and the ice comes in, and then the freezing, thawing, the breaking of dormancy, the poa plants are dead. Now we've got a seed bank.
That's right.
The question remains, should we seed with bentgrass, or is there a way to recapture the population we just lost? Now, it's never going to happen on the time frame that are going to make golfers nor golf superintendents happy. I'm talking about you and me here academically saying, what's reinvading those surfaces, and is there something we can do to get the perennial POA we had back?
Well, in my experience, that's really what's going to come back, is that perennial POA, because those seeds are down in that soil. That's your seed bank. The one thing about POA annua that's different from creeping bentgrass is that POA annua always comes back, no matter what happens, heat, drought, cold temperatures, ice damage, the POA always comes back. And the superintendents that I've spoken with that have both bent, have had experience with both bent and POA, they often tell me they sleep better at night when they have the POA on their greens, because it does always come back. Now that seed that comes back, you might think, oh, there's the annuals that are going to come back because they have most of the seed. But really, once you get those mowing heights back on that grass, those perennial POAs are so much more competitive against the annual types that, in my experience, the greens
that
have lost.
Yeah. So what I've noticed is after the winter damage, if you really start getting after it and mowing it intensively, and typically this happens in anthracnose areas too, morphologically, the plants that come back look annual. They flower a lot. They're coarser textured. They're coarser leaf textured. They're more open canopy. My experience has been it takes quite a while. In fact, we go through crazy maladies like bacterial wilt all of a sudden becomes a very large problem in these damaged areas. They tend to struggle through the heat of the summer after initially coming back, even if they're treated with pesticides for the summer pest problems they might have. So my observations don't jive with what the science is saying, that the perennials should come back. They look almost like weedy annuals if we try to keep these putting surfaces in play after some catastrophic failure. So is there a transition that can happen, that maybe what first invades, reinvades, is, or recolonizing is more annual type, or is that not even possible?
Oh, no, that's entirely possible. I guess it depends on the severity of the damage. If you've lost entirely all of the grass there, then if you looked at the frequency in that seed bank, depending on how old the green is, that frequency of the annual types could be very much higher than the perennial types. And really, the only way to counter that would be to have a commercial source of greens type POA annua. That might be a good time to come in and redo your greens into a bentgrass. I know a lot of courses do that as well. But then you're set up with that problem of battling the Poa annua.
And yeah, to exclude it from the surface. And of course, one of the things we've seen a lot of guys do, and we've certainly been encouraging this, and that's another reason I was pleased to see your article, is, you know, if you've got good greens that are doing well with Poa annua, if you're harvesting those cores, spreading them out and making your own sod plugs, you could, you know, introduce the plants that you've developed, so to speak, under your management, and just reintroducing them back into that environment where maybe because of a low spot in a green, it was killed. So that idea
That's
of
right.
plugging in turf that you've been managing a certain way has got to be a scientifically good way to go in recovering damaged surfaces, right?
Well, and that's right. And if you do have those old Poa greens, the best thing you could have would be a nice Poa nursery. Not all golf courses with Poa greens have Poa nurseries. I've actually seen a lot with bentgrass nurseries.
Right.
And when they get a hydraulic leak, you know, they go to the nursery and they get that bentgrass sod and they put it out there and it looks terrible. And
yeah.
and so then they have to spend a lot of time, you know, plugging the Poa back in. I've seen courses that have converted from bent to Poa by just exactly what you're saying is taking these small mini tine cores and putting, you know, putting them about 2 to 3 cores deep and rolling it and heavy top dressing and reestablishing Poa greens that way. So yes, any surviving greens could certainly, on your course, could certainly supply the needed plant material to replant greens or damaged areas in low spots. Yep.
Okay. So now I've sort of indirectly introduced some of the crux of what I want to talk about with you, and that is that this idea that if you start giving and doing things to Poa annua, whether it's cutting it low or spraying it with fungicide cocktails or constantly providing it insecticide cocktails or nutrient cocktails are popular too, you know, NPK
sure.
plus micros plus aminos plus, you know, glucoheptanate and a variety of compounds that these guys are adding. So here's my bottom line question, and here's what I tell guys. The more you start to do to Poa, the more you have to keep doing to Poa. If you keep giving it these things, you're developing a plant that then becomes reliant on those things. And the hope of moving towards less inputs is not feasible because you've been giving it all these things for so long. Am I on the right track, or I am really off the rails and maybe just sort of convincing myself of it, that the more we do the more we have to do to it?
Yeah, Frank, I think you're right on the mark.
Okay.
I met a superintendent, it was at a course just outside of Sydney, Australia, and he had Bermuda grass fairways and Poa annua greens. And he decided, originally he had bent grass greens, but he decided to convert to Poa. And what he would do, and this is kind of a good example, when anthracnose came in the summer, he would let it sort of, he wouldn't spray right away. He would let it sort of take out the weak ones. And what we've found in all of our collections is there's about 5% of the Poas out there that have really good field resistance to anthracnose. And basically what he was doing was just naturally selecting those out. And so when anthracnose would come in, he would let it take out the weak ones, and then he would spray. And then he would start propagating out the ones that really look good, that had that resistance. And I guess I visited him. He'd been there about 10 years when I visited, and he was it just happened so that there was an anthracnose outbreak, and his greens looked excellent. And he had just sort of naturally propagated these things out. So I think that Poa annua will really finely tune itself it finely tune its adaptability and its genetics to your management. And so
the theory that the more you give it, you know, for example, and here's an example that's been wandering around in my head, and I'm, you know, really talking off the cuff here, but we did a fair amount of work looking at potassium nutrition, and a lot of it was on bent grass, but we also saw it sort of bear itself out with some annual bluegrass as well, especially at Bethpage. When we started, you know, going to nitrogen-only fertility, we went a number of years without supplying much other than nitrogen, primo, and iron to these putting surfaces, mostly POA, in play for about 15 years. And the POA didn't all go away. I mean, much of the POA adapted to the management that we had. Now, is it possible that we actually developed a POA that could get by with less potassium or could get by with less other nutrients, that the plants have that kind of plasticity to adapt to those kinds of subtle, even nutrient changes? I know pests are one of them. That's an easy one because it's lethal. But nutrients are more subtle, and yet one that a lot of guys spend a lot of time wringing their hands about how to manage. And I'm wondering if the plants will just adapt to what's there over time.
I think you're exactly right. I think that they will finally adapt to even slight variations in nutrition and in mowing height and in irrigation and top dressing and traffic and cultural practices. POA annual is unlike any other grass.
That's right. And so eventually, you know, over time, you can actually, you know, sort of have a POA that might be requiring less inputs. But of course, the challenge the superintendents face, and what we'll do when we get back, David, from our next commercial, is really venture into an area that's even more complicated. And that's for those that have decided to go to bentgrass, is it reasonable to expect, even with new tools, to keep annual bluegrass excluded? So when we come back from this break, Professor Huff and I will finish up our conversation talking about controlling and keeping annual bluegrass out.
Golf course superintendents, now you can aerate and fill 9 inches to 11 inches deep with minimal surface disruption and cleanup. The Maximus Deep Aeration Instant Fill Service from Dryject injects 1 pound of sand per square foot and leaves surfaces ready for play again in 1 hour. Visit MaximusAeration.com.
Welcome back to Frankly Speaking. This is Frank Rossi, the TurfNet Media Network, the radio network, TurfNet.com, and at Cornell University. And we're finishing up the last few minutes of our conversation with Professor David Huff of Penn State University. And David, when we finished just a minute ago, I totally set you up now for the question that I know I particularly want to get your opinion on, especially with the devastating winter damage that's come through a lot of the regions. A lot of people have opted for the bentgrass option. Is it reasonable in your mind that without constant intervention, we'll be able to keep annual bluegrass out of these surfaces?
Well, I have seen courses that were just absolutely pure creeping bentgrass. There wasn't a POA to be found, and they were beautiful. They were pretty old greens, and they had some just excellent putting surface, and they were POA free. But in order to get that, they walk those greens at least once a week and would take a pocket knife and cut out the POA when it came in.
Okay.
And that is about the only way that I know of that you could absolutely keep a bentgrass green POA free. And it really doesn't matter where you're at in the country or the world. POA annua is probably one of the most widely distributed plant species on planet Earth. It's pole to pole and on the equator. So it's really worldwide. And no matter where I've went, I found POA. But that's sort of the flip side. If you're going to have creeping bentgrass, then you're going to be battling Poa annua as the invasive weed that it is, and it truly is invasive. It gets into everywhere.
So let me ask you this theoretical question that's been bouncing around my mind. Is there a way, you know, one of the things we tend to do, and even though the bentgrasses, you know, the A's and G's developed at Penn State, even Penn Cross with three parents have lots of parents, and one would suspect a fair amount of inherent diversity. Do you believe that moving forward, one strategy for potentially combating POA and being a more resilient environment, should we be planting, you know, the five or six best creeping bentgrasses in a stand and planting these poly stands of bentgrass in hopes that they would have periods where some did better than others, maybe more competitive, less competitive, and that might be one way of helping keep annual bluegrass at bay, is actually introducing even more bentgrass diversity?
Well, I certainly diversity is a good thing, and it buffers you against environmental extremes. I honestly don't think that it's going to contribute too much to POA invasion. I think what's a better strategy is to, if you look at the bentgrasses that have been bred, they've actually been breeding them to be more like POA annua. More upright growth habit, higher shoot density. And so those types are going to be more inherently more competitive against Poa annua. But Poa annua has a lot of tricks up its sleeve, Frank. For example, it can adjust its root architecture under, we've seen it under low nitrogen and salt toxicity. And Poa annua roots adjust, whereas creeping bentgrass roots do not.
So, we only have a couple of minutes, but since you said it,
yeah.
What kinds of adjustments in their exudation, in their growth, do they make?
Well, it's called their specific root length. And so the Poa annua can take the same amount of resources, sugar, photosynthates, nutrition, and adjust the architecture of the root physically. Whereas we've never seen that in creeping bentgrass. But under
well,
stress,
David, as we come to the end, I think I never doubted we'd have an easy 45-minute to 2-hour conversation about this. We are wrapping up here, David, and I guess as I ask you just for a 30-second, if you had to tell superintendents moving forward, should they? You believe they can adjust their management in a way that can make POA more sustainable?
Yes, I think they can. My bottom line advice would be to stick with a management program, you know, that fits with your course, with your philosophy, and stick with it. Don't keep adjusting. Don't keep changing, because the POA will then try to track your changes. If you're very consistent over a very long time, mowing heights, cultural practices, the whole nine yards, then the POA will become more and more adapted to that, and more of your green will look, it'll be much more uniform and give you a much better playing surface.
David, thanks for, I really appreciate you taking the time to join me on this episode of
Frankly
Speaking. All right, and you take care, and everyone else, thank you for joining us on this episode of Frankly Speaking, and we'll look forward to having you back on our next episode.
You have been listening to Frankly Speaking with host Dr. Frank Rossi on TurfNet Radio Network. Check back for schedules on future programs. Thanks for tuning in.